This is Mark Lane.
This is Robert Groden.
This is Dick Russell.
This is Jim Mars.
This is Lisa Pease.
This is Dr. David Mantic.
This is Cyril Weck.
This is Jim DiEugenio.
This is Joan Mellon.
This is David Lifton.
This is Jerry Polakoff.
This is Gary Shaw.
This is Bill Kelly.
This is Greg Burnham.
This is Gerald McKnight.
This is Sherry Feaster.
This is Joseph McBride.
This is Bill Davey.
This is Dave Ratcliffe.
This is David Talbot.
This is Doug Horn.
This is Walt Brown.
This is John Barber.
This is Judge Joe Brown.
This is Vince Palomera.
This is Bill Pepper.
This is Richard Belzer.
This is Oliver Stone.
This is Governor Jesse Ventura, and you're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds. T-minus 25 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite not point verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite not point verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another segment of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we're talking to author, researcher, Jim DiEugenio from sunny Los Angeles. Is that right?
That's correct, Len. Good evening.
Well, it's snow and cold in Vancouver, man. Oh, I can't believe how cold it is up here.
Well, you can't have a Mediterranean climate everywhere.
All right. How are you?
Well, not too bad.
Good. I played your presentation from San Francisco last week. I'm hoping to chip away at these and air what I can. But that was very good. It was...
Thank you.
Yeah. And I hope everybody enjoyed that. It's up there on YouTube. So good job.
That was a very nice opportunity. You know, I don't know if your audience knows the occasion for that. But Gary Aguilar has had these two private seminars up there in San Francisco where the cream de la cream of the JFK research community attended by invitation only. That was a really nice opportunity to present something like that. And so that was, you know, people like yourself, Lisa Pease, all right, and Max Good, you know, and several others, you know, I think there were about 31 or 32 people there, if I recall correctly.
Right.
David Mantic.
Peter Neal Scott.
So that was a really nice occasion to do something like that, because I figured everybody would appreciate the level of work that went into doing something like that. And I have to give credit to my friend and colleague Al Rossi, who actually put together the PowerPoint for me. I thought that was a very important part of the presentation. So I really think that presentation I gave up there on the whole Vietnam issue, I'm pretty sure that's the state of the art of where the issue is today. And because I incorporated as much new material that I could find, there's only one thing that I believe I left out, and that was the material that McNamara allowed a couple of people to listen to. And when he left office, I believe in either late 67 or early 68, he did what they call a debrief. And he said that he and Kennedy had decided that the extent to which they could go ahead and extend aid to Saigon had already been reached. You know, that they weren't going to go any further than where they were at. They could supply them, they could train them, they can lend them money, etc. But they weren't going to go any further than that. And he said that had already been decided before Kennedy was killed. All right. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm very comfortable with saying that this is this phony debate about Kennedy and Vietnam should be closed and never uttered again. Okay, I just don't see any point in arguing about it anymore. I think essentially, now I'm not saying the whole story, but I think essentially Oliver Stone got it right back there in 1991, you know, with Fletcher Prouty and John Newman as his main advisors. I think he essentially got the whole thing right. You know, and I think the only reason he was attacked so bitterly is because the truth had been covered up for so long.
He was trying to enhance the ideas that Jim Garrison had come up with and show Jim Garrison, I think, as a hero for going up against the government by saying, listen,
right.
I'm reading these things, and you can't trust the Warren Commission. This is all wrong.
Right. Yes. And as I said at that conference, you know, Jim Garrison really was the first guy who was a Warren Commission critic who did say that Kennedy was getting out of Vietnam. Now, it didn't quite happen as it was in the movie. He didn't discover that as it was in the movie because him and Prouty exchanged letters afterwards. Okay, but while he was actually investigating the case, I believe in 68, and this is one of the things that came out of the things that Garrison's children gave the National Archives, a professor from Ohio University wrote him a 26-page essay, handwritten. It wasn't typed, okay? And that was the title of it. Kennedy was withdrawing from Vietnam, all right? And so that's how we got the idea. You know, it just didn't come out of nowhere. So that's how we got the idea. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is, really, in reality, there really wasn't any dramatic license to that. There really wasn't, if you know the facts. But unfortunately, we didn't know that because the ARB didn't come out around yet. And that's what I'm trying to say. That's what I'm trying to say is if you would have had everything out there, can you imagine how powerful that movie would have been? You know, so, you know, these people who criticize the film as utilizing dramatic license, the only reason they had to use a dramatic license is because the archives were closed. That's the reason. But as far as Vietnam stuff goes, that was pretty much right on. I mean, everything was pretty much the way it happened, you know? So, you know, I really, really believe, you know, that Oliver got mugged on that, you know, and it was really very, very unfair. And that's why I put the thing up from George Lardner. Okay, that, you know, Oliver started being attacked, you know, 7 months before the movie was exhibited. All right, it was terrible. So anyway, that's where that came. That's why I made that presentation. Okay, before we get into,
sorry, there's that old line that says, "How do you know when you're over the target? That's when you're getting all the flack." So,
right.
You know.
Right,
you know.
Right.
He was pretty close to what was going on. You know, we're talking about Jim Garrison, his trial. You know, even the good book, right, On the Trail of the Assassins, you know, not mm-hmm. one. And, yeah, quite an epic movie.
All right, one thing I wanted to bring up before we get into the main part of the show is the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. I don't know where Walt Brown got the information that me and Lisa Peace kept him off the signatory list. But that's simply not true, okay? It's just it's simply not true, all right. So I look the way you know the way I feel about these things. If Walt wants to get on, I'll be glad to take my name off, okay? I just don't think it's all that big of a deal. The big deal is that David Talbot put this thing together, you know, and that's the important thing. Not the signatures that are on it, you know. So, you know, look, your show, the way I look at your show is that I do your show in order to dispense information because there's an interested audience out there. They work they don't have the time to go ahead and do the things that I can do since I'm retired. And so my job, you know, is to fill them in and to keep them current on what's going on. All right. If I would not use your show as any kind of a platform, okay, for people taking shots at me, I just wouldn't do it. If I ever do it, Len, please shut me up and tell me to stop it. Okay. All right. Now let's get to.
Okay.
Let's
stop
get
it.
To.
Okay. Good. I'm glad you got.
All right. Yeah. Now Michael LaFlamme's review. And you might want to have him on your show next week.
Sure.
His review of Lisa Peace's A Lie Too Big to Fail is up at our website. Okay? So everyone should read that, please. It's a very good book, you know, and it's a nice review. All right, so please take a look at that. Now, there's something else in the news items that I want to bring your attention to. And like I said, I don't think enough people listen or take a look at our news items. If you go to in the news, all right, if you go to 1, 2, 3, the fourth item down, all right, where it says Hostie, they went outside to watch a presidential parade. Go ahead and hit that link. That's a very, very interesting document that Malcolm Blunt fished out of the archives. Okay, Malcolm Blunt is one of these unsung heroes who actually lives in England. He comes over here every few months to go to the archives, and I don't know where he gets the time or the money or the energy, but he does. And so Bart Camp went through the files that he had collected, and this is an interview with Oswald from the first day. And he goes ahead and he explains, you know, his actions that day. Okay. All right. And as Bart has it at his website. Okay. It says that, all right, he went to lunch. He went to the second floor to get a Coca-Cola, ate lunch, returned to the first floor, and then he went outside to watch the parade. Do you understand how important that is? Because it says he went upstairs to get the Coca-Cola, okay, and then he went downstairs to eat lunch, and then he went outside. Is that something, or is that something?
Well, it's staggering, right. You know, so much for putting him on the sixth floor.
Well, not just that. What he's saying there is that the second floor lunch encounter didn't happen. A lot of people, like myself, have been arguing that we really don't think it happened for a lot of different reasons, which I put in my book. But this is really, really – it's amazing in this case, Len, isn't it, how long it takes – to get certain documents out, you know, and then you understand, well, you know, why not? But that's a pretty good example of why it took 55 years to get that story out, all right? So anyway, I thought that was very, very interesting, all right? Because for the simple reason, Len, that I think that's as close as we're ever going to get to an audio tape of Oswald in detention. You know, the whole story was that somehow the Dallas police couldn't afford a tape recorder, or they didn't have one in the whole building, all right, to tape those questioning of Oswald. Well, this is pretty much as close as you're going to get, all right? And that's his explanation. Okay, now, there's a couple of stories.
I was going to mention that it is amazing that a lot of people from all over the world are following it as well. You mentioned Malcolm Blunt and, Bart. You're in their UK, right? And
Bart Camp, I think, is actually from the Netherlands. and he moved to England.
Okay, well, so I'm just saying people all over the place are not just Americans. And somehow, you know, you would think that there would be more interest, but it's everywhere.
Right. Now the story I want to go to next is actually comes from Canada. All right. And it's about the work. Do you know Maurice Phillips?
No, I don't. You mentioned that before. I think I got it mixed up with
Maurice, I think, is from Eastern Canada. Okay. You're on the West Coast, right?
Yeah.
Maurice, I think, is from Eastern Canada. And he started this search through the famous Bloomfield Archive. All right. Now, to back up a little bit on this, if you recall, back in the 60s, Jim Garrison stumbled upon this information that Clay Shaw was mixed up with this mysterious Italian company called Permindex, which is an extension of Centro Mondiale Commerciale. It was a very, very, very interesting discovery because Clay Shaw had it in his Who's Who in the Southwest directory up until 1964. Then it was removed after that year, which I think is very interesting. Shaw lived on to about 1969. All right. Now, people always had doubts about what the hell this thing was, who sponsored it, etc. And people, the only guy I know who at that, back in those days, did a very good investigation of it was Paris Flammond in his book, The Kennedy Conspiracy, which I think by far of the early books was the most complete book about Jim Garrison. Yeah. He sent away for these Italian newspapers, okay, to get his information, had them translated, and he actually went into the history of this very, very murky, mysterious corporation, which actually began in Switzerland. Okay, the city of Basel, all right, and then moved to Rome when they were kicked out of Switzerland. They were kicked out of Switzerland because of a controversy over where their money was coming from and who some of the people on their board of directors was, all right? And so this created a hubbub in the newspapers in Switzerland, and they decided to leave, okay? And so they relocated the city of Rome, right? And so it was in Rome that Clay Shaw, which was Shaw's favorite foreign country, that Clay Shaw joined the board of directors, all right? Now, when they got to Italy, pretty much the same thing happened. It was a very controversial company. Because of A, the roots of their funding, and B, some of the controversial people on their board, like George Mantello, changed his name to George Mandel, who was part of the Jewish refugee racket, all right, among other people. And what happened is that when Garrison's investigation broke, there began to be reports from several newspapers, international newspapers, none in the United States. No newspaper in the United States carried the story. But there were some newspapers throughout the world, like in Canada and Italy, that did carry stories about Permindex and Clay Shaw's role in it, all right? It began to be a serious problem for the CIA. And so the CIA adapted a cover story that somehow this was all a KGB disinformation tale, all right, about Shaw and Permandex, et cetera. All right, well, that was never true. Because slowly over time, there began to be declassified documents, all right, about Permandex. For example, the State Department, which I published in my first book, the first version of Destiny Betrayed, you know, which said, yes, it was a for real company and had very mysterious connections to it. All right. And of course, we know that, of course, Shaw was with the CIA at this time. All right. So that's one CIA, at least one CIA connection. All right. So then as time went on, in that book, The Matrokhin Archive, all right, the whole wave of books of former KGB agents who then went and had and defected, and they supposedly brought all these documents. One of the early ones was A Sword and a Shield by a guy named Matrokhin, and he said the same thing, that somehow Permandex was a CIA disinformation story, all right, which I always thought that the whole... that whole association between these British and American newspapers and publishing companies paying these former KGB agents hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, for documents that most of them weren't genuine anyway. They were supposedly handwritten. You know, they couldn't afford a copying machine. All right. You know, then they turn up in the United States. I thought that was all a bunch of baloney anyway. All right. But now... because of the work of two people, actually three, Maurice Phillips, all right, Michelle Mehta, and John Kowalski, we have a much deeper understanding, you know, of just what this whole association stood for and what it was about. Now, Maurice Phillips started it by getting into the Lewis Bloomfield papers, which are in Ottawa, which is, that's the capital of Canada, right?
Great, yep. Yep, Ottawa.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, that's where our good friend lives. Fred Litwin. You know, Liz
is
hysterical.
Friend. He's not my friend.
He's from your country, okay?
Okay, well,
Litwin.
Oh, nothing.
Litwin lives in Ottawa. He lives in this is so funny, it's ridiculous. He lives in Ottawa. Okay, so in other words, if he wanted to walk over to the archive, he could have looked at these documents. He didn't. Instead, what did he do? He went ahead and fell for that Matrokhin BS and put it in his book. I mean, this is the kind of researcher Fred Litwin is. All right, this is the kind of guy the guy is. Okay, I mean, this is, you know, you couldn't write anything better, you know, about him. Well, anyway, Maurice Phillips actually went in to the archives. He has a blog, and I'd advise everybody, you know, just, you know, punch in Maurice Phillips. I think it's something like Secrets or something is the name of his blog, something to do with secrets. And he's the first guy who actually got in to the Bloomfield papers. And it's very clear now, you know, that Garrison's correct about Permandex. It did serve as a kind of meeting place for a lot of really, really, really interesting people. Like Ferenc Nagy, the former president of Hungary, would be just one. Bloomfield was getting investors for them. You know, and by the way, he was soliciting people like David Rockefeller and the Rothschild family, you know, to put money into Permandex. Okay, you know, and on top of that, Nagy was actually asking the CIA if they would like to have a member on the board, okay, and if they would like to go ahead and invest money in it themselves. Now, of course, all kinds of rumors and all kinds of, because Bill Turner actually wrote in one of his stories for Ramparts magazine, you know, that that Guy Bannister put together some money, all right, to be taken over to Europe, all right, by a courier, Maurice Gantlin, you know, and it was to be part of an assassination attempt on de Gaulle, all right, which makes a lot of sense because, you know, Alan Dulles did not like de Gaulle very much, you know, and a lot of the CIA guys were backing the OAS, you know, the secret army against de Gaulle in his dispute with Algeria, all right, and so that kind of thing, you know, is the kind of controversy that Permandex generated, you know, and here you have one of Franck Nagy's homes in 63, according to Mae Brussels, was in Dallas. And then you had Shaw living in New Orleans. All right, so this is all very, very fascinating stuff. Maurice Phillips started this, and Michel Mehta got some documents in Italy, and he wrote a book about the subject, okay? All right, and it's called CMC, all right? And he, Michel calls his book The Italian Undercover CIA and Mossad Station, all right, and the assassination of JFK. And it seems that he's correct about this. There was at least one and probably two members of the Mossad associated with the board, okay? One of them was Shimon Peres's brother, all right? And so, you know, this is very, very fascinating stuff, you know, and it was also related to Propaganda Due. Are you familiar with that organization, Len? Did you ever hear anybody talk about that?
P2? No. Well, yeah, okay. P2. Go ahead, though.
Okay, P2 was this very, very shadowy, secret, pernicious organization that centered in Italy and was a very exclusive, I think it was basically Masons. Okay, you had to be a Mason to be a member. And it had about, I think, 900 members at its pinnacle. And its whole motive was to prevent any kind of leftist takeover in Italy. And they were related to all kinds of atrocities, like the infamous bombing of the Bologna train station, which I think 85 people died at. All right. And there finally had to be a commission called the Anselmi Commission, named after Tony Anselmi, who was a politician in Italy at that time. And when she was done with their investigation, Propaganda Due was outlawed in Italy. And by the way, I should say, its reach was further than Italy. It was international. All right. And so it was funded by Sedona, who was a banker, and Michael Sedona, who was a banker in Italy at that time, all right? And, you know, so when people say, when people say, do you believe in conspiracies? Well, what do you call that? You know, what do you call Propaganda Due? I mean, what is that? You know, and anyway, in Michel's book, he puts a definite link between the two, that they both were related because they had this, I think, the same meeting room, okay, through an associated company, all right? So it's a very fascinating look at the politics in Italy and how the CIA was so interesting, and I'm sure you're aware, the interest in Italy with the CIA began way back in 1948 when Alan Dulles rigged the 1948 elections in Italy out of the law offices of Sullivan and Cromwell, you know, and that was really one of the very first times, even though Dulles wasn't in the CIA at that time, he was using people in the CIA like Angleton, okay, to rig those elections, all right? And then, of course, you have Shaw going over there. You have William Harvey being stationed there in 63. And Angleton worked out of Italy for many years after the war, very close to the Borghese family who attempted a coup in Italy in 1970, all right? And so what, to kind of concentrate this, if you remember David Talbot's book, The Devil's Chessboard, when Kennedy visited Italy in 1962, Schlesinger pushed on him the idea of encouraging the Christian Democrats to incorporate the Socialist Party into the mainstream, okay? And he did. He did push that, all right? It's called L'apertura finestra. That's called opening the window. And you can wager that people like Shaw, people like Harvey, people like Angleton, you know, were dead set against that opening because they had put so much time and effort into keeping Italy a conservative country, all right? And so then, to finish the story, John Kowalski then, Maurice Phillips decided not to take the case all the way, you know, that is to, because he had to have a hearing to get the rest of the papers opened when the Bloomfield family resisted opening the rest. And John Kowalski, a subscriber to Kennedy's and King, he's on a forum, he wrote an article for us. Was he on your show?
No,
did
I don't
do
think...
your show once?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. And he's from Canada, all right, and he went ahead and went through the hearings, and he got most of the other documents out. And we have a lot of the documents in this article, okay? All right, so if you want to see what real research is all about on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, that is Maurice Phillips and John Kowalski on one end, okay, and Michelle Mehta on the other end, then please go ahead and read this very, very interesting article, okay? It's a treasure trove of information, and I'm really serious about that, okay? And the Mehta book is, you know, I don't think I've ever read a book that goes more deep into Italian politics and the CIA's influence on it, okay, as the Mehta book. Okay, it's an utterly fascinating look at that, you know, what a mess it turned out to be. Okay, so that's something I would encourage on everybody. Now, the other main thing I wanted to talk about tonight was the Hammarskjöld case. There's a film that was at Sundance, premiered at Sundance, called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, all right, in which they actually tried to examine the new evidence for the murder of Dag Hammarskjöld. All right. Now, to toot my own horn, we had been on to this, Lisa Peace and myself, had been on to this since about 1997, okay, when we did a famous two-part article for Probe magazine, which is still worth reading, on the Congo. I did part one. She did part two. You know, I concentrated on Lumumba. She concentrated on the murder of Hammarskjöld. All right. And we were calling it that back then. All right. Then Susan Williams' book came out a few years ago called Who Killed Hammarskjöld. And that was really a kind of leap forward with the evidence in that case. And that provoked United Nations to reopen the investigation. And you have this film out now called Cold Case Hammarskjöld. So the world is finally catching up to where Pro Magazine was back in 1997. All right. Now, I have always believed that this was a very, very important episode. Okay. For the simple reason that it was the first time that the United Nations actually placed troops into a foreign country, all right, in order to save the government, okay, against imperial forces, all right. Dag Hammarskjöld, first of all, let me tell you a little bit about Dag Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld was from Sweden. He was a professor of economics. If you know anything about the Scandinavian countries, from about the turn of the century, they believed that you had to, the government had to be a balancer between the interests of private corporations and the workers, the average ordinary people, all right? So, therefore, they believe that the state has to intervene, okay, in order to keep the table even, all right? That's why they have that high rate of taxation up there, and they have these incredible social welfare laws. You know, like, in the United States, if you're a woman and you get pregnant, you're lucky to get 2 weeks off. What is it in Canada, do you know?
No, I'm not sure right now what the current maternity leave is.
In Sweden, you get 6 months, and the state pays for it. All right, those are the kind of social welfare laws that they have over there. All right, so when Hammarskjöld took over the Secretary General office at the United Nations, all right, he looked at upon the UN as a balancing act. In other words, the General Assembly would represent the emerging third world countries, you know, coming out of the travail of colonialism and imperialism. And so he saw it as his duty to make the UN the voice of the weak in the world, all right? And so when the Congo situation erupted and Patrice Lumumba became the elected leader of that country, Belgium said, we're leaving, okay, and so we're going to have elections, you're going to have a constitutional government. Patrice Lumumba won the election. And, of course, Belgium wasn't leaving. They decided to go ahead and pull out very abruptly because they thought the faster they pulled out, the quicker that confusion and pandemonium would set in. All right. Now, I had a discussion with John Newman about this once, you know, and I said, you know, the real bad thing about that is that Lumumba was an elected president and that was a constitutional government. And he said, yeah, but Jim, you know, there was nobody with any education there, you know, with any money, et cetera. And I didn't think fast enough to say, well, that's why Hammarskjöld did what he did. That's what he saw his job as to go in and to play the referee. So when the chaos began to set in, what happened is that Lumumba looked for help, and he looked for help from three different places, the United States, the Soviet Union, and Hammarskjöld. The United States turned him down, of course, because under Eisenhower, that's what they planned on doing. Hammarskjöld was slow to organize his force to put into the country, so he went to the USSR. Lumumba went to the USSR. they responded with supply trucks, vehicles, and technicians. And, of course, that's all the CIA needed to go ahead and say there's a communist takeover like Castro in Cuba going into the Congo, going on in the Congo, which was complete and utter baloney. You know, Hammarskjöld, you know, knew that. Lumumba was not a communist. And so what happened is this began the CIA plots to kill Lumumba. And to give John his credit, he does a very nice job of that in Countdown to Darkness, listing all the plots that Eisenhower and Dulles employed to kill Lumumba. And you got to be really sharp and count, but I think there's five. Five. Now, can you imagine this, Len? This poor, downtrodden country in sub-Saharan Africa, okay? And here it is, the CIA and the White House trying to kill this independent leader because he somehow is a threat to the free world. This is how crazy those guys were, okay? And so between the CIA and the Belgians, okay, and the breakaway state of Katanga, which the Belgians financed to break away from the rest of Congo, because that's where all the rich natural resources were, they hatched a plot to get rid of Lumumba, okay, and they did. They went ahead. When he tried to break out of house arrest, they captured him. They shipped him to Katanga, the rebel state, and the Belgians had him killed by a firing squad, all right? Then they dipped his body in sulfuric acid, and when the sulfuric acid ran out, they incinerated his remains. In other words, they cremated him. All right. So now, when, by the way, that's 3 days before Kennedy goes into office. They knew that Kennedy would favor Lumumba. All right, and that's why they did what they did so quickly. All right. And so Kennedy, when Kennedy gets in, not knowing Lumumba's dead, he reverses the Dulles Eisenhower policy. Okay? He's now going to favor the independent government against the imperialists. All right? And so Hammarskjöld sends in a 20,000-man army to back the new leader, a guy named Cyril Adula. And what happens is that he manages to control the Katanga breakaway state, all right, and he's about to meet them for a truce. And in the middle of September of 1961, his plane goes down, all right? Now, to go through all the weird things that happened that night, a good short article on it is by Lisa Peace at Consortium News. I think it's called Death of a UN Hero. The longer one by Susan Williams, all right, is called Who Killed Hammarskjöld, all right? But let's put it this way. The official investigation was a whitewash. There were too many witnesses who saw too many funny things in the sky, and there were too many tapes, radio communications, that something was going on up there. All right? And they got these Land Rovers to the scene very quickly. All right? And they were in and out within a matter of a couple of hours. And I think I got a letter from one of your listeners about this very subject, okay? Let me read it because I think it's a point that you brought up with me once, all right? Is this it? I think this is it. All right. By a listener named John Shondum. You know, an odd thing happened to me just after reading the excellent Congo piece by Jim DiEugenio in Deep Truth Journal. I was struck by his description of when they found Dag Hammarskjöld's body, unburnt, and with an ace of spades tucked into his tie. Strange image, which Jim described as unexplainable. So randomly, within the next few hours, I was watching the Winter Soldier documentary. Okay, if you don't know what that is, that was the seminar put on by Mark Lane, Jane Fonda, and Donald Sutherland. Okay, I think it was in, do you remember, Lane? Was it in Canada or was it in Northern Michigan?
I think they had it just across the border so they could broadcast them and people in America were hearing it. Like, you know, okay, over the radio airwaves and that.
All right.
The Winter Soldier?
Yes. And that was, you know what it is then, right?
Yeah, for people don't, go ahead.
It was for all these Vietnam veterans who congregated in this place, and they told the stories of all the atrocities that the United States was committing in Vietnam. Very, very powerful stuff. You know, Mark Lane then wrote a book about it, which the New York Times, through Neil Sheehan, tried to discredit. All right. But anyway, during the Winter Soldier documentary, he says, there's a part where a soldier describes their body count competition with other squads in Vietnam. And he notes that his unit, Charlie Company, used to put, guess what, on the bodies of their kills. You got it, the ace of spades. That coincidence may or may not mean anything, but if the tradition of using the ace of spades in this fashion could be traced to an origin, we might find a common ancestor of the Dag Hammarskjöld assassination and the Vietnam War, maybe even a usable clue for assigning responsibility. Maybe it is explainable after all. And he has a link to YouTube where I imagine you go ahead and punch in Winter Soldier documentary, okay, and you can see highlights from it, all right? So maybe that's what that whole thing was about. You know, maybe, I don't know, all right? But it sure is an interesting parallel, you know, to how the heck Hammarskjöld was found with that card in his collar, you know? So anyway, the interesting thing about this is that when Hammarskjöld died, there was a lot of suppression of the circumstances of his death. And in fact, we link to an article here where Edmund Gulyon, Kennedy's ambassador to the Congo, all right, that night suspected that Hammarskjöld's plane was shot down. And he even suspected the guy who this film, Cold Case Hammarskjöld, accuses of actually shooting the plane down. So please, this is very important. Kennedy took up Hammarskjöld's cause after he died. And by just force of his personality and his powers of diplomacy, he kept Congo free and independent until 1963. And then when he died, of course, well, we know what happened with everything after Kennedy died. Everything went to hell in a handbasket. You know, and that policy was reversed after Kennedy's assassination, and it ended up being a fascist state under the dictator Mobutu. All right. So please take a look at this. It's a very interesting set of articles, and it's a very overlooked piece of history. All right. All right. So now let's go to some letters. All right, which never run out. Okay. All right. Let's take them in order. All right. This deals with the Tippit case from Ken Murray. Why didn't Nelson respond to the Tippit murder? That's a heck of a good question. To give you some background on what the heck he's talking about. Roger Nelson was an informal partner of J.D. Tippit, but on the day of the assassination, they were in separate cars. There was a broadcast order that went out, okay, I believe around 12:45, that their two cars the broadcaster, Mr. Murray Jackson, said, I think it's 87 and 78, please report to Oak Cliff. All right. Well, Tippett did go to Oak Cliff. Nelson went to Dealey Plaza. All right. So the question is, why did Nelson do what he did? All right. You know, why did he do what he did? Now, everyone I think who knows this case understands that the broadcast messages that day had three different versions, okay? And they differed in important ways, all right? So if you're asking the question, why did Nelson disobey the order and Tippett was in Oak Cliff? Some people, and I advise everybody to read Joe McBride's book on this, End of the Nightmare, because I think it's the best book we have on the Tippett case. You know, some people believe that that message wasn't for real. All right. Now, if you can believe it, and everybody listening to the show can, I'm sure, Nelson was never questioned by the Warren Commission, to my knowledge. You believe this? In other words, he was never asked a question. Why, if the tape says that you were supposed to go to Oak Cliff, why did you go to Dealey Plaza? You know? All right. Was Nelson the person Tippett argued with at 12th and Marsalis? I'm not sure about that. I'm not really sure. Some people say that they saw Tippett arguing with somebody at that corner. Okay? That might be true, but I don't know. Why did Nelson disobey direct orders to be in Oak Cliff? I don't know that either. I don't know that. The only thing I can think of is he really wasn't disobeying orders, Ken, that maybe the tape was dubbed in later. I don't know that. Where are the Dallas police logbooks? That's something I can't answer either, because the guy he's referring to, an online writer named Dusty Road, said that there should have been logbooks where the dispatcher or his assistant wrote down all the orders as they were broadcast. He says he knows this because he used to work in a fireman's unit, and that's what he did as a dispatcher. He wrote down the orders after he broadcast them, and he says the logbooks aren't there. I don't know what happened to him. Why is Harry Olson's testimony during the Tippett period or time frame partially sealed? I don't think that that's actually accurate. I think what they did with Olson is they went off the record, okay? And there's a difference, I think, between sealing something and being off the record.
Do you want to explain who he is?
Oh, yeah, sure. Harry Olson is one of the most fascinating characters and most unexplained characters in this whole damn case. Harry Olson was a policeman on the Dallas Police Force, and I think he was there from about 1958 or 59. His girlfriend was Kay Coleman, who worked for Ruby as a dancer. All right? Now, that's pretty interesting right there. A few weeks before the assassination, Harry and his girlfriend went ice skating with Jack Ruby. That's how close they were. All right. And Ruby ran in to Olson, and he broke his kneecap. So it was in kind of a cast at the time of the assassination. Now, what's so fascinating about Olson and Coleman is that when Kennedy comes into town on the 22nd, all the officers are reporting to work that day. They've even had reserve officers like Croy, Kenneth Croy, who came into work that day. But Olson didn't. Now, I understand that he was injured, but he could have taken a desk job that day. All right. Well, he begged off because he said that he had to guard an estate in the Oak Cliff area. All right. That was his excuse. So when Spector asked him, okay, well, what was the address of the estate? And he said he didn't remember. Okay. Then he asked him, who asked you to do it? He didn't remember that either. Now, when, I don't have to tell you, everybody remembers where they were.
Yeah.
The day Kennedy was killed.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But somehow, Harry Olson can't remember exactly where he was, and he can't remember why he was there. All right? But, guess what? They ran into Ruby. Kim and Kay Coleman ran into Ruby that night. All right? There's different questions about how long they talked. And these estimates about how long they were together go from anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes to 3 hours. All right? Now, Arlen Specter questioned Harry Olson. And according to Don Thomas, who wrote a book on the JFK case, he told me that Specter understood all the problems in Olson's testimony because he actually talked to him before he took the stand. All right. And he was kind of worried about this. Yeah, well, there's no need to worry because the Warren Commission was, you know, a cover-up from beginning to end. All right. But he was worried how this was going to look because, as other researchers have pointed out, there is no estate in that area of Oak Cliff. Okay? So, see, these are the kind of things, you know, that just drive people mad about this case. You know, why didn't the Warren Commission get to the bottom of this? You know, why did Olson feel that he had to say what he did? Okay. Why did he have to, I don't remember the address where I was at. Oh, I don't remember who asked me to do it. Oh, I'm lying. There is no estate in that area of town. So see, any decent detective will tell you, all right, that when somebody tells little lies like that, you know, it might be because they're hiding a bigger agenda. And so it's your job, you know, to get to the bottom of it. You know, as the great Allard Lowenstein said, you know, my experience as an attorney is that people with nothing to hide don't hide things. So what were they doing by telling those little white lies? You know, and did it add up, you know, to a bigger lie? You know, well, we're never going to know. We're never going to know. Okay, because obviously, Specter and the Warren Commission didn't do their job. Now, another interesting thing about this is that about 10 days to 2 weeks after the assassination, Coleman and Harry Olson skip town. They leave. Okay? They end up getting married. All right? Now, they want to keep on piling, because the excuse was that he got fired. All right? That Harry Olson got fired from the force. So they went ahead and they quit. She quit her job at Ruby's. He quit his job with the police force. And they moved to California. All right? Now, if it was me and I saw something like this, I would have put out a full court press on this guy. You know? In fact, in Joe McBride's book, End of the Nightmare, he goes as far as to say that Olson should have been one of the suspects in the Tippit murder. All right? Because I don't have to tell you, Oak Cliff is the area where Tippit was killed. All right? So it's very, 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 very interesting, to say the least. And I'm really glad that Kenny went ahead and gave me this question, because I don't think we've ever talked about Harry Olson before. All right? So, and it's something that deserves to be talked about. So thank you so much for that question. All right, Ken. All right. You want to do a couple more?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, let's do a couple more. This is from Andrew Gentile. Hello again, James. With regards to Black Op Radio info you provided, I cannot access here work as job will not allow me to pay for YouTube. I do not have access at my home, can only use a net here. I don't have resources to upgrade my entire world to the 21st century yet. Anyway, thanks for providing the info. I don't know if you broadcast my questions. Well, yes, I did. Thoughts from the previous pros, or if you just broadcast the answers. I always felt that Francis Gary Powers was sincere, and he would be thankful he was piling the U2 that day over Sverdlovsk, because he carefully considered everything that was questioned about by the Soviet authorities. I admire the man a good deal. He was always tickled that Kelly Johnson had the guts to offer him employment at Lockheed, right after his grilling by the CIA in Washington, D.C. Believe I am right for the reason for Oswald going to USSR. Certainly the CIA was not setting him up in November of 1959 to be a patsy at Dealey Plaza 4 years later. Well, I don't think I said that. I don't think they were doing that either. I thought I said that they were just infiltrating a wave of false defectors into the Soviet Union to try and get information, because they couldn't get a lot of information on the Soviet Union, the inner workings of the KGB at that time. All right? They were probably banking on Nixon winning, correct? Well, let's put it this way. I think they hoped Nixon was going to win. All right. Although, also believe I am right about the three shooters in Dealey Plaza, their locations, etc., from the previous post. Again, no way to fire the rounds in 6.3 seconds at a moving target 90 yards away with a bolt-action rifle. Well, I'm never going to disagree with that, okay? I believe in the Carlos Hathcock experiment, okay, which I've talked about on this show more than once. The greatest sniper of the Vietnam era, if he couldn't do it, and he said he tried more than once, then it couldn't be done, all right? If LHO had wanted to kill JFK, had he been in the sixth-floor window, he would have fired one round into JFK's face and head when the limo was approaching his location while the limo was on Houston Street. I think we all agree on that. It sure is nice to be able to email to folks who were alive on 11/22/63 and remember that day. Just saw a site with your birth date. Not sure of what were you guys doing that afternoon. I was in grade school, I believe, if I recall correctly. I was in my sixth grade class over near the windows. We had a split up class between the sixth grade and the fifth grade. All right. And I was in the row in, excuse me, one row in from the window side of the room when the intercom, the secretary in the principal's office came on the intercom and said that President Kennedy has been shot in Dallas and they were suspending class for the rest of the day. That's right. What were you doing, Len?
Yeah, I was in grade one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the same thing at lunchtime. We were on lunch and then we were just all sent home.
Okay.
And, you know, my mom was watching TV that afternoon. And
yeah, that's what everybody did. They went home and watched TV, yeah. Quite frankly, JFK's death ruined a lot. Our current president has done some things to further hostility between nations today. Okay, a lot of nations have too. JFK had some issues, but I will always believe he wanted to make the world a better place for the human race. Most combat veterans would agree. My cousin Don Gentile did not have a college education, could not enlist in the U.S. Army, and he went to Canada and enlisted in the RCAF. What's the RCAF?
Royal Canadian Air Force.
Oh, okay. Went to the United Kingdom, flew with the Eagle Squadrons, then flew with the 4th Air Force in Europe. Broke Rickenbacker's record with 22 air and 8 ground victories. Tragically killed during a flight test in 1951 near Andrews Air Force Base. Okay. And can you get me on the Wayback Machine so I can go back to June of 1963 and swing on my little swing set the rest of my life? No, I'm sure a lot of people feel that way, considering what's happened in the world since, but we can't do that. Thanks for your time. Keep the discussion going. Your reply would be welcome. All right. No one I come in contact with cares to deal with the JFK assassination much anymore. All right. Sincerely, Andrew, a second-generation Italian. Okay, thank you for your questions, Andrew. And the last question of the night is from Carl Long. Oh, this deals with the San Francisco conference. Excellent presentation by Jim on a Cliff Notes version of Vietnam and the real history, including Eisenhower, Dulles, Nixon, Kissinger, and others, true personal long-time involvement in Vietnam War, and revealing the long-suppressed lies. Looking at it from a macro level, as a person that formerly trained in a pilot CIA program for political forecasting, master's level, at one of two initial colleges years ago set up by the CIA in contract with those institutions, it ties together a very incriminating case for the purposes and people that actually were behind President Kennedy's assassination, in my opinion. The sum total of the pieces fit together like a complicated puzzle that is finally recognized from a viewable level to make the overall connections. There is no such thing as a multitude of political interconnected coincidences occurring on their own independently. In political forecasting, the multiple common links depict the motives and the perpetrators of the desired end results. The end game was for unlimited, uncontested involvement in Vietnam for political and ideological purposes, military intervention for control over other countries' freedoms, and military corporation financial purposes. That means to get that desired effect is by taking out those that are in the way, not just JFK. The overall end game was that the Vietnam War to justify the... Isn't that pretty much what Fletcher Prouty said?
Yeah.
Wasn't that his thesis? About the high cabal, yeah.
Well, he was just making observations, right?
Yes. Thank you for your great show and Jim DiEugenio's exceptional way of tying the pieces together, as I've never seen so clearly before in one presentation. I ask that you stand back for a moment, look at all the interconnecting and overlapping facts and coincidences, and see what is this telling you as a researcher, okay? Well, good. I'm glad he liked it, because that's what I was actually trying to do. I was trying to put a lot of the dots together in a rather short, I think that was only 50 minutes long, you know, in a short presentation of, you know, who was responsible for what and how the media was so awful in the Vietnam era. It was just terrible, you know, and so how Kennedy had to do what he did in a kind of almost secret way. You know, because he was being hammered by people like Neil Sheehan and David Halberstam, you know. And so, and then, of course, what happened is that the bad guys took over, you know, and John. Now we have these tapes with Johnson revealing what he really felt about, you know, what Kennedy was doing. He knew he was withdrawing and he didn't like it. And he didn't waste very much time into, Brown beat McNamara in the reversing policy. Then Nixon comes in, and even though he knew that the war was lost, even though he knew that, because I had that memo, NSSM1, okay, you know, which showed that, he continues the war for 4 years. He increases the bombing, you know, and then he invades Laos and Cambodia, making those two situations even worse than they were. And like I said, in Cambodia, you know, I think everybody agrees that the invasion of Cambodia and the bombing of Cambodia displaced Sihanouk, okay, brought Lon Nol to power, and then overthrew Lon Nol and gave us the rise of the Khmer Rouge. All right, and by the way, I got it. Have you ever seen the YouTube video of Bernie Sanders debating Hillary Clinton? And he brings up her association with Henry Kissinger and how in one of her books she called Kissinger her mentor. Oh. And how she vacations with Kissinger in the winter at Christmas in the Caribbean. And Bernie Sanders brought this up at one of those debates. And he said, "I'm very proud to say that if I become president, I will never even talk to Henry Kissinger, let alone let him be my mentor." I mean, this is the guy who caused the overthrow of the Cambodian government and brought to power the Khmer Rouge and caused the death of 2 or 3 million people. He was one of the most destructive Secretary of States in history. Everybody should take a look at that. It was one of the most inspiring minute and 10 second sound bites I've ever seen. I'm sorry I missed it when it first came out. Okay, but that's the kind of thing that we need in this country to purify the system. All right, we don't need people who feel like they need to be mentored by a guy who should be in jail. Okay, like Henry Kissinger. All right, so I was glad somebody emailed me that. All right, so anyway, okay, so that's it. We're all caught up with the letters now, Len, if you can believe it. We're all caught up.
Okay,
clean that all out.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot for your time tonight, Jim. We'll talk to you in the near future.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is your 20th year, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Let's hope you get another 20.
Okay.
Okay, good night.
Good night.